And welcome to Thrift Shop Biography. This is the one about the Dalai Lama. Thank you for listening. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Excellent. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. So, bit of a different one this week.
Yes.
Because I was in the thrift shop and I found the autobiography of the Dalai Lama. And we've done all of these great singers and actors, and I thought this would be something really different for us.
Freedom in Exile, it's called.
Freedom, because he's got more than one autobiography.
He's got loads, it turns out.
Yeah, he's got a lot to say.
This has to be the definitive one, though, doesn't it?
I would say
it's
so.
It's the beginning right up to 1990, which is huge.
It's when everything happened.
His first 55 years. That's the interesting part of any autobiography, isn't it?
I would say so.
I would.
Unless you were Susan Boyle.
Yeah.
And your life started at 55.
Yes.
So I should say I loved reading this because there's so much to learn, but I almost feel not qualified to talk about it because it's so far out of my remit. I feel comfortable talking about Britney Spears and George Michael, but for some reason I'm a bit scared of talking about the Dalai Lama.
Well, I was sort of scared of reading it, I'd have to say, because I thought it would be really worthy, but it's actually so light. As in, it's heavy material, what he's talking about, but the way he tells us is very personal. It's just like a chat.
And it's funny.
Yeah, it's really storytelling, isn't it?
It is, but I have to say, some of the stuff in this book is some of the worst stuff I think I've ever read.
Well, it's brutal. Yeah. That's humanity for you, though.
Yeah.
It's inhuman and
inhumanity. Yes. So actually, I ask you this every week, so I should ask you it this week. What did you know about the Dalai Lama before you read this book?
But all I knew was that he was the religious leader of Tibet that was in exile. But I didn't know what that meant in terms of Buddhism or when he came to power. I imagined it was inherited. I didn't know most of it. I just knew the absolute basics.
Yeah.
Same as you.
Yeah.
Did you know how he became the Dalai Lama?
Oh, my word.
I just thought it was somehow passed on, hereditary or something. I have no idea. Okay, let's talk about it.
Let's start. Let's get on with the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
So, as with most books that we've been reading, the Dalai Lama is not actually his real name.
Yeah. No, he has loads of different names, but his main one that he was christened with is Lamo Thondup.
Okay, full disclaimer here. There are a lot of we names don't know how to that pronounce we are going to mispronounce in this book.
Lamo Thondup.
I think that's close enough.
Yeah, well, he does say that he's written this book in English. He's actually written it in English. It's not translated because he thinks he'll be able to communicate more widely to more people. And there's quite a few words he types in English that would have been written in totally different transcript, or if they were Chinese, they'd have had an X instead of a CH. Mm-hmm. So I think he's trying to help us pronounce things.
So Lamo Thondup
actually
means wish-fulfilling goddess.
Goddess. I know.
So this is like we were talking about...
a boy named Sue again.
Yeah. How Americans always call boys girls' names and vice versa. But it turns out that Tibet people do as well.
Yeah. Why would they not have just picked a wish-fulfilling god? Why did they have to go for a goddess? It's quite weird.
Yeah.
To us, because we like to...
Maybe they have different ideas of gender and stuff.
Why can't you be named after a goddess just because you're a boy?
Yeah.
Fine.
But obviously he has a title, Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Which means?
It means living Buddha or God King or just a human being, he says.
Well, that's completely different to what I've got. It means ocean of wisdom.
Oh, well, I just chose the ones I chose to remember.
It's Dalai is a Mongolian word meaning ocean and Lama is an alpaca.
Yeah.
And okay. Lama is a Tibetan term corresponding to like guru, teacher.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it means ocean of wisdom. But that he said that's a real broad interpretation of those words. So yours, the things you said are also valid.
Well, you were doing what it literally means and I was doing what it means.
Oh, wow, so you get everything with this podcast.
Yeah.
Both sides of the meaning of the Dalai Lama.
Because if people treat him like a god king, right, that's one way of interpreting his position, but it's not how he sees himself. And I thought it was really nice that he starts his book by saying, I just see myself as a human being or a simple monk. And I'm going to tell this story as a simple man and a monk. I think that's great. So you've already shared all of that, you know.
Yeah, but he has to say that, doesn't he?
Glow.
He has to be humble.
He doesn't have to. But I think if you're writing an autobiography, you might have to be human. He also, later in life, in exile, changes the whole setup of the Dalai Lama from a theocracy to a democracy. He actually doesn't want it to be all godlike and worshipy. Mm-hmm. He changes it legally so that you could be outvoted if people didn't like you.
Good for him.
Yeah, because he personally made those changes. I think he really means it. He just wants to be a man who does a job, mm-hmm. who's committed to Buddhist principles, but he's trying to take himself down a peg, which is great. That's what I got from it, did you?
I got many things from this.
Yeah,
this book completely opened my mind to religion. It's weird because we've touched on religion in other books, but we've never done the book of a religious leader before.
I mean, Dolly's close, but...
No, she is close, the Dalai Lama.
Hey!
Hello. Oh, God, she changed my mind on a lot of things spiritually.
Yeah.
Sharon Stone, now the Dalai Lama. So but there was a lot to digest because, like, everything in this book was new information to me. And it shouldn't have been. So I'm glad I've read it.
Yeah, me too, actually. Yeah. I'm glad I know this knowledge.
So he was born Lamo Thundup in 1935.
Yeah, in remote Tibet. All right, now let's tell him how this came about. Okay, he was one of 16 kids. His mother had kids for 30 years.
Yeah.
Because there was 30 years difference between the oldest and the youngest. That's a hell of a long time to be dropping kids.
Yeah.
But they had 16 and only 7 lived. So that's why in those times when they had big families. And they were farmers. And he was actually born in a cow shed, which is very familiar. Little baby Jesus.
Did he have a manger to rest his head?
He may have, mightn't he? But Buddha was from 2,500 years ago. So it precedes little Jesus. It really means something to me because Jesus was a person who was born at a time. And so was Buddha. And I didn't even know that. You know, they were real people.
Yeah.
He made a massive impact. And their teachings continue to this day. So I didn't even know the origins of Buddhism.
That he was a real person.
He's a bloke. Yeah. And he preached amazing doctrines and they were taken on and Buddhism
happened. He called Buddha?
Yeah.
What was his surname?
I don't know. They do tell you in this book. Dalai Lama tells us all about it and I've forgotten. But he actually goes to the place in India where Buddha was
born
and preaching, and it really means a lot to him. But that's like me going to Graceland. It's still going to someone's place where they're from. It's celebrity almost.
Yeah, no, I totally get when the Dalai Lama is telling us about his life and the processions and the whole town coming out to clap as he goes by. It is celebrity.
Yeah,
it's celebrity as much as royalty is. He's a religious leader as much as Elvis is.
Yeah, you've just been picked. Everyone needs to worship something higher than them, whether it's imaginary, invisible faith or an actual person. It's like something we need to do.
Yeah, although I do find the fact that Buddhism has this massive leader in a massive procession where everybody's draped in gold and it's 500 people long and all the peasants from the town who can barely afford the grain to eat are throwing themselves on the ground and crying. And I find it slightly incongruous with the teachings of Buddhism.
I agree. It's insane to read, actually, that this person who sounds like a normal man is telling you that all this stuff happened to him.
Well, it's the weird thing that it did literally happen to, like, he didn't go seeking for it. They came and found. Tell us a story about how they found him.
Okay, so it is. I laughed out loud. I was like going, what?
Yeah.
It's kind of hilarious, right? So the 13th Dalai Lama, there's been Dalai Lamas for centuries.
Yes.
And each one is supposed to be the reincarnation of the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to wait because obviously it takes a couple of years after death because there's 9 months preparing a baby as well. So they have to wait. So in 1933, the 13th Dalai Lama died. They only went seeking the next Dalai Lama in 1937. When he was 2 and a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So they waited 4 years whilst this bloke's dead and he's lying in state. And at some point, his head turned.
I know.
His dead head, which is probably just decomposition. Yeah. It turns to the northeast. This stuff is just... But it's, I don't want to laugh at it because it's all the traditions of Tibet and everything. So this head turns to the northeast. They go, it's a sign. And they consult the oracle who has a vision. And he says, oh, I've seen a monastery and it looks like this. And there's a path up to a hill and around. Then there's a small house and it's got really strange guttering. And he describes what he's seen in this vision. So they set off towards the northeast.
Yeah.
It's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
And eventually
nuts.
They find a monastery that matches and it's in this little remote village. And then they follow it to the path, to the hill, to the thing. And then they find this strange guttering that was on the Dalai Lama's family home and go in. And he appears to recognise some of them and points at things that were things of the Dalai Lama's and says, mine, there's a few tests.
Yeah.
And he passes the tests. He's under 3 years old. And they go, this is it. He's the 14th Dalai Lama. He's a reincarnation of the last Dalai Lama.
I mean, but it's bizarre. And they take him away. And he's not the only child they visit.
No, that is why I find it quite odd that they found this house with the guttering, because it's two of his older brothers are deemed to be the reincarnation of Rinpoche's, which is a high lama.
Yeah.
So they're quite high up in the order of things in the religious government set up. So they've already been to their house twice and taken two boys. So they do know the house. It makes you wonder if they just described, you know what I mean?
You think they knew they were going for him and then they made up a reason afterwards?
I don't know, but it's a bit odd that they definitely knew that family. They've already taken two of the boys out.
I mean, it's just bizarre to ask because we don't practice Buddhism, so we don't know the history of it. But I have to say, it's no more absurd than the origins of any other religion.
No, or royal families and stuff, just because they're born into the family. Yeah. Going snatching them from another family is just another way of doing it, really, isn't it? And it's not like he never saw his parents again, because they joined him and they lived within the grounds of the palace. They saw him
they
every
won
day.
The lottery, really, didn't they? Because I did when I first read it, and they said they come and took this like 3-year-old boy. I kind of thought, what the hell are parents doing about that? And then he says, oh, they get to live in the grounds of the palace.
And they become
and stuff,
high nobility.
Yeah. I'd let them have my 3-year-old.
Yeah. But it's really bizarre to us because it's just, I didn't know any of this.
It is fake because you know how much people laugh at Scientology because it's basically all science fiction.
Yeah.
And then you kind of think, well, if you want to look into this and other religions, it's equally science fiction, really. It just has more history embedded to it. But it's equally as bizarre.
Yeah.
Here's a question. Is Lamu Thundup, the guy whose book we're reading, is he the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama?
Well, he answered that himself. He says, I can't say for sure, but there are many things that indicate that he definitely says he feels spiritually linked to him.
Can I tell you what I think?
Yeah.
He's not. I mean, he's not.
Yeah, but that's what I think, but that's...
But
of course he's not. He's just a bloke. He's a little baby from a farm.
Yeah.
From somebody else's family.
Yeah.
If you go in there, Virgin Mary wasn't a virgin. I don't believe that either.
I know. But then also, towards the end of this book, when he does say about whether he's the actual reincarnation of previous Dalai, because it's not just what this relies on, is not just him being the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama. It also relies on the 13th Dalai Lama being the reincarnation of the 12th.
And
So it's a whole line of reincarnation that somehow each one of them has been miraculously found.
Then there's these Rinpoches, and one of them, who is his brother, he later says died, and it was really, really sad. He died of a long drawn out illness. But he says at the time of writing of this book, we have located his reincarnation and he's currently a very cheeky 3-year-old boy.
Yes, yes.
And he recognised certain people from the government and named them. And so we know it's his
reincarnation. Yeah, it's constantly, it's happening right now, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you kind of think, oh, right. To deal with death, you have to believe that they've come back. But then in a way, without having to believe in actual reincarnation, isn't it just reassuring to know that life goes on? It doesn't have to be the same person again. It's just that life goes on and on and on. That's like a whole broad reincarnation concept.
And also he says that, Dalai Lama aside, by the same reasoning, he says, well, he doesn't believe that Chairman Mao, Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill just happened. He thinks that they're also part of a cycle. I don't think he explicitly links it to reincarnation, but it's just a circle of life and influence, and leaders always happen. But where do those leaders actually come from?
Yeah.
Is it autonomous, or is it somehow built into the larger fabric of life? I think it's just autonomous. Isn't it?
This was
the wrong book for me to read.
I also love that he's really interested in science, and he says, and he really believes in science, and some people can't understand that he does because he's supposed to be all spiritual. But he thinks the two don't have to be separate, and he actually thinks some of the practices of the Tibetan monks should be scientifically looked into because they've actually hit upon a few things that you can...
Oh, what about the human body?
Yeah.
Wow. So now here's the thing, right? I'm cynical of a lot of things in this book, but things like that where he talks about the high state of meditation
exactly
and how science hasn't researched the human body to figure out how Tibetan monks can meditate for so long and increase the temperatures of their body.
Yeah.
It's like hibernating animals.
It is exactly like hibernating, because they sat monks out in the snow overnight and monitored them just once, and their body temperature did not drop all night. They were in high state of meditation, and they reckoned they only breathed 7 breaths a minute. That is hibernation.
And they put wet sheets on them in the freezing cold, yeah, and they dried them off with, yeah, the heat from their, yeah, body.
Yeah, you're right. So there is a lot of amazing stuff that they've managed to...
If it's true...
Oh, not this again.
I mean, I'm taking him at his word.
Yeah, yeah, true. Anyway, it's very fascinating, and it's not for us to say... Yeah, it's for everybody to...
Yeah, it's, I'm taking it for what it is. It's, yeah, a fantastic story.
Yeah, and I thought, okay, what's the main philosophy of Buddhism? And I looked it up, and it's to accept that everything is impermanent. And I thought, man, that covers so much, doesn't it? That means your health, that means your finances, it means friendships possibly, but also means life and death. You can't ever expect anything to be permanent. And if you could fully accept the change of everything... in your being, you're going to be a lot more peaceful, aren't you?
Hey, as far as religions go, I think Buddhism is the one that I could get on board,
yeah,
with, because it is much more about the self and self-improvement.
Yeah, and also looking after others,
yes,
is the main thing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite nice. It's quite a nice philosophy. And he said that Tibet became a much more peaceful country once they fully embraced Buddhism, because they used to be warriors. And at, yeah, some point they took over parts of China and stuff. So, you know, they're not innocent. They just became a very peaceful nation.
There is some hypocrisy in this book.
Are you going to say about the vegetarianism?
Yes.
That made me howl.
I know.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's so much about animals and stuff, and about, because at the beginning he's kind of like, you can't even swat insects,
yeah,
away.
One of their main things is you cannot take any life of any being, of any something being, he says.
Sentient being.
Sentient being. That's a major rule of Buddhism.
Yeah.
But other people can kill them and then we can eat them.
Yeah. As long as you're not specifically doing it yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says, oh, there's quite a lot of Muslims in Tibet, so they kill all the animals and we can eat them.
Yeah.
You're like, hang on.
But he does also say that harvesting in Tibet can be incredibly hard. So not every year do they get a crop of maize and stuff. So they do have to resort to eating meat. And I get,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that is absolutely fair. It's just a bit funny.
But then he also says, like, he shoots the, oh, hawks and stuff to keep them away from the little,
yeah,
birds. Oh, but I don't kill them. I just hurt them.
I just inflict pain to teach them a lesson. I'm like, isn't that what the Chinese were doing in Tibet, though? But you know what I mean? It's the same theory.
When he was talking about being a vegetarian, yeah, yeah, there are a few grey areas. Yeah. And then also about him having pets. And he actually says...
When he punished the parrot with a stick.
He punished the parrot with a stick. One of his cats died because he chased it up a curtain and it fell off. I've never heard of a cat dying from falling off a curtain.
I know, they always land right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he found a disabled kitten with bad back legs that he then said was a reincarnation of the cat that climbed up the curtain and died because it had hurt its legs. Anyway, and then at the end of the book, he says, oh, well, animals have taught me you can't have an animal as a pet because they always run away, which proves we all want freedom. So, no, your pets run away because you hit them with a stick. You make them fall off curtains and die. Pets don't run away unless you treat them badly.
Even at one point, he admits when he's installed in this palace that everyone way below are all bowing and scraping on the floor, and he's blowing spit bubbles and dropping spit on their heads. And he says, thank God I grew up and grew out of that. And I'm like, this is the sort of thing that makes me like him, actually, is because he doesn't promote himself as a godlike thing. He actually writes stories where he's gone off the righteous path and he hasn't behaved right. And he said I was angry and moody and did stuff wrong.
I think if you're a child who at the age of 3 has been taken away from your family and installed in a monastery, I think you're entitled to play up from time to time, because that must be so confusing.
I know.
When they took him initially to the monastery and inducted him as the Dalai Lama, his parents were there, but then his parents got sent home and he was there on his own for a long time.
Yeah, he was actually.
He had his big brother was there with him.
Yeah, it's funny because his big brother's only 3 years older than him, which puts him at 7.
Yeah.
So his big brother at 7 became, yeah, his parent sort of thing, looks after him.
The whole thing is
only
so
3.
Weird. Yeah.
A toddler. Yeah, he gets, oh, it is mad. Anyway, it's really amazing to read how everyone knows he's the Dalai Lama. So he's put on a big golden throne and this massive ceremony. Then there's two palaces. One's up on the hill looking down over the town, and there's a picture of it in the book, and it looks absolutely amazing. Apparently they pretty much destroyed it when the Chinese invaded, but they've restored it now. And
is that the Norbalinka?
No, the Norbalinka is the one that's flatter.
So it's a Potala.
The Potala
is the one up on the hill.
Yeah, and it is so unbelievably imposing. It looks like one of those palaces from something like Wakanda.
Mm-hmm.
Those sorts of films where they just sort of CGI this amazing palace on a mountain, and it's so epic, it looks like that.
Well, they're probably based on
them. Because they're probably based on them. But it's so striking and
imposing. Oh, to think they actually exist.
Over the
Yeah, because you've only ever seen them in science fiction films,
but
they actually exist up a hill in Tibet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes Buckingham Palace look like a little the house next door, you know. Really silly. It's just a silly little house. And then, yeah, this other place,
Norbalinka,
it sounds
which
like
means
it's
a, jewel park.
Exactly. It's a very much more of a sprawling place with parks, and it's sort of walled, more like a Windsor castle. But
in Tibet.
Yeah, lots of animals and tigers, all sorts. A much nicer place where you can be outside within walls. Because he was very protected. He couldn't just go for strolls or meet people because they wanted to promote him to be this godlike deity. So you have to keep him away so no one thinks he's normal.
So his first year there, he actually says, it was the last temporal liberty I was ever to know.
Yeah.
So it's his last year. This book is called Exile and Freedom. But actually his
last... No, it's Freedom in Exile.
It's called Freedom in Exile. Yeah. But his last feeling of freedom was when he was 4 years old.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It sounds kind of horrendous to live in that place. And he's not even allowed to be seen looking out of a window.
Yeah.
I'd very like the Queen in Buckingham Palace. And his only friends were the prisoners he could see through binoculars. He could see him marching around the square within their prison.
Gosh, it's just such a weird, unique existence, isn't it?
Yeah. It's amazing because this is the sort of thing films are made of, to be able to read somebody writing down these experiences. I don't know any other book like it. Probably there's millions, but what other amazing emperor of old ever wrote about their experience, or a queen or king wrote about it? It's amazing to get inside the head of a kid that is told they're the leader of 6 million people by the time they're 10.
Yes. So he's installed now officially as the spiritual leader of Tibet.
Yeah.
And he says that the 13th Dalai Lama who came before him actually had this premonition that soon Tibet was going to be invaded and everybody would have to fight for their lives. He basically had a premonition of what was to come.
Yeah.
And then there was that really weird natural phenomenon where, like, the earth cracked open and the sky went red.
Yeah.
This is in 1950.
Do you know what I think that was?
What?
I think they were nuclear testing. But they would never have told anyone. They would never have told the world. They would never have told. It would have been totally secret.
That makes total sense for what they actually used Tibet for.
Yes.
But before they came in and took it over, you think they were nuclear testing on it?
Days before. Yeah, I reckon. That's just my theory.
They let off a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, because
there was
no information
shared.
You wouldn't have got out into the world, yeah.
Well, why does Dalai Lama not realise that now, writing this book?
He just says he believes in mythological things. Whereas we're more cynical a lot, you are.
Wow. No, no, now you've said that, I'm completely...
Does make sense. So they see this massive phenomenon in the sky, and the earth actually shook and the sky went red.
They thought it cracked open and it was this big imposing omen of bad things to come.
Yeah, it was.
Actually, it was a nuclear bomb going off.
Yeah.
Yeah, because just a couple of days later, everything kicked off, didn't it?
All the soldiers came, yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, he talks a lot about all the different traditions and celebrations, which is all really important because you get this idea of the festivals and culture and things that happen that are about to be crushed because their whole way of life is about to be over forever. I doubt Tibet will... Well, it will never be Tibet again. It's China now. I know that to this day. They're just occupied Tibet. You can't go back. All his descriptions of life and celebration festivities, even from his throne position, are the last you'll ever read about Tibet as it was.
Well, this is happening. Now I know it's a nuclear bomb. The nuclear bomb was dropped during an opera festival.
Yeah. You really think it
now you
sense.
Said it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. But mind you, why is that not reported more
because
widely?
Because that's what I mean, because they weren't reporting. You couldn't get into China.
Oh, right.
No, the news wasn't.
So when it all kicked off, there was an opera festival going on. So it's almost like this amazing, fantastic festival was happening. And then things got very bad soon after.
Yeah. Do you know what, by the way? Because he had a few visitors when he was young from US officials and British people, and they gave him toys and Meccano and things like that, and a watch. And then there's this visitor, Henrik Harre, who was an Austrian, and he'd escaped from a prisoner of war camp in India, and 5 years he'd wandered about until he found Dalai Lama. And they made really good friends. And he left before the Chinese came, but he sent a letter saying, you've got to get out. But that's the bloke that wrote 7 Years in Tibet.
Is
that
it?
Became the film.
Ah.
Yeah. Is that Brad Pitt or
yes,
something like that?
Yes, it is Brad Pitt.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
So that would be him playing that Austrian bloke. So we need to watch that.
We need to watch that now.
Yeah, because a year and a half he was in Tibet being really good mates with the Dalai Lama. So that'd be kind of really interesting, especially knowing it's just before it all went wrong. So, yeah, the raid on Tibet was in 1950. So the Dalai Lama is only 15.
Oh, God, it surprises me. All this is going on. And he keeps saying, I was 15.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, my God, he's still a child.
Yes. And he's the leader of his people who are under attack from China.
Well, that's the thing. At one minute, he's a 15-year-old spiritual leader having a nice time at an opera festival.
Yeah.
And then a couple of days later, he's a 15-year-old spiritual leader with his country preparing to go to war against a much bigger entity.
Absolutely. Also, at that point, they say, you're ready to actually become the proper leader.
Yeah.
He said, I don't feel old enough. And they checked with the oracle. And the oracle said, you're ready. He describes this oracle bloke later. And he says, like, it's a really high up position in government to be the oracle. And you go to him and he goes into a trance. He's got this sword and he puts this massive heavy helmet on, which could break his neck at any point. He's jerking around and dancing and gone into a mad trance. And he said, it's amazing how specific his answers are when he's really off his head and then collapses. And you're like, isn't it though?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
He's a nutter.
Well, he's just a member of parliament who's got answers already. But the oracle goes, oh, trance. No, you are ready. As in, yeah, that's not a vision. That's just what you think.
Oh my God.
It's hard not to be a bit cynical. It's just hard for us.
So, look, the first inkling they get, there's a telegram that comes from the governor of Kham, and he says there's a raid on a Tibetan post by Chinese soldiers which killed the officer of that post.
Yeah.
And that's terrible news to receive.
He straight away knew that there's no chance, if it comes to war, that they could ever defend themselves against China, which is 100 times the population of Tibet. Plus, they've gone into the modern times, they've industrialised, and Tibet is still really rural and basic.
They have no modern weapons whatsoever.
No.
Also, it's not just that they have a much smaller population. Also, because of their religion, Buddhism, being a soldier is not something that one would strive to be, because they think about soldiers the same as butchers. It was not something to be proud of. So they're armed forces. Well, they weren't even armed. Well, they were armed with...
But it's against their religion to kill and take a life. He keeps saying it's so unbelievably deeply against the Buddhist belief to take a life. So they no way, if aggressors come, that you have any... You just have to peacefully accept it, which is what he did. He tried to make it work as carefully as possible and to try and defend the rights of his people, whilst knowing there's nothing he could do, but maybe we can compromise and maybe we can do this peacefully. Maybe I can protect the rights of my people to have religious beliefs and carry on their practices and live in peace, and we can work this out together. And that's all he tried to do for 5 solid years before he had to flee. And he worked quite hard at that.
I mean,
can you do?
I mean, the Chinese are a communist and they want Tibet. They're just going to come and... I mean,
of course
Tibet
they are
like no competition.
What they did is they did it really sneakily. They never said, we're conquering you. They go, it's a peaceful liberation.
Coming to make it better
for
everyone.
We're just going to bring you into the modern age because you've fallen behind and you're our neighbour and it's only nice that we try and help you. And so they just lied.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we'll work with you. We'll not as much as take a needle from you. And then later he says they ransacked it.
Oh, my God. They taxed everything, even the monasteries and stuff.
It was an invasion
masquerading
as a liberation. And it's just all propaganda. It's just it's nothing we haven't done as the British Empire. It's nothing that history hasn't seen since human beings were invented.
So I think it's not happening now.
It's happening now.
Yeah.
One country blaze across borders and take over another. We are the cancer of the earth.
I was quite despairing reading this book, kind of thinking, oh, you know, it was written 30 years ago. Maybe we've all learned something from this.
Yeah, no. And also, it is the history of all time. It's the Romans. It's everybody. It's just what people do.
It's human nature.
Sadly, it is.
Unfortunately.
Before this all happened, and yeah, we have just breezed over it, but up to them coming in and him having to flee, they just eased their way and they brought in 60,000 troops, then 80,000, then 100,000 troops. And that was just into Lhasa, basically, from the east, over and over and over. They just took over Tibet gradually. And because they brought so many people, they had to set up so many encampments, houses, hospitals, schools. You know, before you know it, the schools are teaching Chinese. They've built roads. They've used enforced labour of Tibetans.
Oh,
they've
imprisoned
so many people and used them to build everything. You can't build an empire and pay wages. But the history of all time, Dubai's just been built on slave labour effectively from India and places, because if you ever watch a programme on that, it's still going on. They're absolutely abusing humanity. That's happening now just to build Dubai. It's exactly the same and it happens so fast. Like from 1950 to 1990 when he's wrote this book, it sounds like Tibet's become almost, well, just completely and utterly modern. Roads everywhere, toxic waste everywhere because they've ransacked it for uranium. They brought collectivization, which is that communist thing where individuals don't farm in little pods.
Yeah.
You just, the land belongs to everybody and then everyone farms it all. And that was the whole communist thing. But it destroyed huge parts of Tibet because they turned the barley into wheat and then the topsoil just eroded and it's turned huge parts of the desert. They ransacked the country for timber. Deforestation happened, wildlife is decimated, they banned their national costumes, they banned religion.
Yes.
They bombed monasteries and nunneries, and we haven't even talked about the humanitarian aspects. It's barbaric, and it's as bad as you've ever heard of any war ever being.
But, you know, in the early stages, horrific. Tibet did appeal to the United Nations organisation to intercede on their behalf, and they didn't do it because they weren't a member.
They weren't a member. I mean, if you think 1950, you've just finished World War II, and everyone's really broke.
Yeah,
broken and broke. So who's going to start World War III? Because if you defend Tibet, you've got to take on China.
Yeah.
And then at some point in the early 60s, India had a bit of a border war with China themselves. And that was partly because they were harbouring the Dalai Lama. But Russia supported India then. Then China backed off because nobody wanted World War III. And who's going to stick up for some Tibetans living up mountains? It's, God, it's horrendous.
Dalai Lama's older brother, they sent him to see the Dalai Lama to talk some sense into him and say, get him to accept Chinese rule. And if he doesn't, kill him.
Yeah.
But he doesn't accept Chinese rule. And as we know, he doesn't kill him.
Dalai Lama says it's preposterous for them to think that my brother would have even contemplated killing me. Like, that's how much they don't understand us.
Yeah.
But that was the first warning he had.
And, of course, Dalai Lama is a spiritual leader, but they have political leaders. They have prime ministers. Yeah. And it got to the point where the pressure on Tibet is like so immense at this point that the Dalai Lama has to ask the prime ministers to resign, which is like a massive, it's almost admitting defeat in a way. The whole thing is hopeless, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I actually thought at one point, why is the Dalai Lama escaping? Why is he not standing his ground? They'd just come in and kill everyone.
They would have killed him.
Yeah.
Okay, so eventually, there's a trip he made to the borders of India, and he was sort of sussing it all out, but he ended up going back because India wouldn't let him in because they said, we can't let you in because it will create massive trouble with China.
Yeah.
And he sent different delegations to other countries to see if they could escape there, and they all said no because they knew that it would make an enemy of China.
And also, they said that if he does leave Tibet, it's just going to cause widespread panic. If the Dalai Lama is seen as leaving, that's going to tell everyone, all the Tibetans, shit, it's the end of days.
Yes. Anyway, he goes back and he realises how bad it's become. He's seen a leaked newspaper from the Chinese that have got loads of heads on sticks from villages, and he realises, oh my God, this isn't going well.
Yeah.
And he says he's got 18 months to train to become officially the Dalai Lama because he still hasn't passed his exams and stuff. So he sets that as his goal and works really, really hard to get all of his learning done, which is very complex. He's very learned.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
A lot goes into becoming the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
But at this time as well, in the 9 months that he's been away, when he comes back, so many troops have now moved into Lhasa, stuff that is doubled the population. So things like food shortages and stuff are happening. The pressure is on from every single angle.
Yeah.
Tibet is not a good place to be.
Not at all. So then there's this point where there's a festival and the Chinese have invited him to the military base to watch a special show, and he thinks this is a bit odd, but he says, okay, I accept this invitation. And then they summon his security and say, we need you somewhere else.
Yes.
You then can't come with any of your security. You can only come with a couple of unarmed people.
Unarmed.
That's... And straight away, he's like, okay, this is an ambush. They're getting me to the military base. I will probably be a political prisoner from this point on. And this word spread about this invitation and what was happening. The whole population of that city started to come out in a massive show of support for the Dalai Lama because they were so afraid for him because they all thought he was about to be kidnapped. Mm-hmm. Thousands and thousands of people gathered around the palace. And it got escalated so much that he had to let the Chinese know, I'm really sorry, I can't come now because it would be dangerous for me to leave, which was a good get out.
Yes.
And so he's like, right, now what to do? So I think at that point, did he leave for the other palace?
Yeah. Norblinka.
Yeah. So he's there, but then everyone's surrounded there. So they absolutely were doing it to protect him, but also to be against China, but very much protective of their beloved leader. And then he got a note from a Chinese official saying, we are going to bomb your palace. Please let us know whereabouts you are within it so we won't bomb where you are. And we're also going to open fire on the crowd.
Crowds,
yeah. So he's like, okay, the only thing I can do now is to get out of here because I'm now endangering everybody by being here. They are going to kill him or imprison him. He knows he has to go. It's exciting then, isn't it?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, he knows he is the person that everyone is looking for. So he takes his glasses off as an amazing disguise.
And he can't bloody see anything.
He can't see
anything. Worked for Superman, didn't it?
So he's being escorted out of the palace.
He's got normal clothes as well.
Yeah.
He's got a rifle, so he looks like he's on guard.
Mm-hmm. And it is exciting. It is like watching a film.
Yeah.
He's fleeing from he says it's the most scared he's ever been in his life, but he knows if he stays there, they're not just going to come for him. They are going to kill the crowds that have come out in support of him. And so with help, he makes a run for it and they start this convoy and off they go. I think, again, the medium guy
said
to them, this is the route you need to take. And it was via a Tibetan village right on the border of India.
Yeah.
But that's like 2,000 miles across inhospitable terrain.
It took them 3 weeks.
And there's like 80 of them.
Wow, yeah. His mother went on ahead under a tarp in the back of a jeep. A few of his officials went on in different ways. The two of them walking out there in the dark and saying, yeah, we're on patrol, right? Yeah, all right. You know, and going past all the masses. God, can you imagine? And then it was like crossing a river on conicals, those little round things. He said they ended up as a group of about 100.
I know, right? This is a thing that I...
He never travels with less than 500 people with him.
I know, so he takes like 100 to avoid detection.
Yeah.
That just told me how expansive Tibet is and the terrain they were trekking across must be so huge that finding a couple of people is the same as finding 100 people.
Yeah.
They must know that. There's no way they would have taken 100 of them if 100 would have caused detection.
And he thinks it's hilarious because when it became daylight, you could see that the wrong saddles were put on the wrong ponies and the big ones were on the mules and the mules were on the... So I'm glad you think that's funny. I'm still really stressed out.
I love that a mule is his chosen mode of transport because they say to him, get on the horses. He had this little mule called Grey Wheels. And they didn't like him riding the mule because they didn't think it was befitting of the Dalai Lama.
It wasn't noble enough. Yeah.
Yeah. But hey, good disguise.
Yeah.
You never expect to see the Dalai Lama on a mule. Well, I was surprised because he'd been to India and they were very lukewarm about him seeking exile there. The welcome he received in India was really joyous. And I was surprised that people were pleased he was there. So I think the political leaders of India didn't want him there, but I think the people of India were happy to see him.
Yeah. Also, Nehru sounds cool, doesn't he?
He does, but he's very, very cautious, but understandably so.
But also, if you listen to the Dalai Lama, he can find the good in anyone. Oh, because we've missed out that he visited Peking. Yeah, he visited Peking within that 7 years and spent some months over there visiting China. And Chairman Mao, like, totally bowled him over. Totally charismatic, intelligent leader that people really listen to. Of course, he was quite young then. He hadn't really met a lot of other people because when he went to India and went into their government, he realised how sincere everybody was, which made him suddenly realise how insincere everyone was in China, and that he realised they were probably speaking because they were afraid to tell their truth. Because he just was so young, and once he sees people who were telling the truth, he realises the difference. It takes him a while.
And also as well, he learnt, of course, that he was meeting people. He was somewhere in China and he met a hotel porter and he said to him, "Oh, it's so nice that your people are really supportive of all of this." And Dalai Lama was like, "What? My people are really angry that this is happening." But the news fed back to China through the press and the propaganda is that the Tibetans are totally up for what's happening.
For being liberated.
Yeah.
It was from oppressors, Western oppressors or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
If you look at that map, though, there's a map printed in the book and you see China. I thought China was massive, but Tibet's a massive bit of land as well. And if you think there's people potting around with some goats and fields in your China, the great communist industrialised country, if you'd look at it and go, "Let's take that."
Yeah.
Because we'll easily be able to breeze in there. They've got no armies. They're all peaceful. Unfortunately, that's just what happens. He was talking before all this happened with China that he would really like to modernise Tibet and bring it up to scratch. And seeing China how it was and he was learning about industry and stuff, he thought, actually, this could be good. I'd like to build roads. I really like cars. I just think in some ways, progress, sadly, is really hard to block, so-called.
Yeah.
Because what progress really is us absolutely trashing the universe. That's what progress is. And it's horribly inevitable if you're a pessimist like me.
I just think the whole world has progressed to a place that none of us were intended for. And I think the ultimate victors of progress are the people who receive our taxes. Because once upon a time, none of us really ever paid much tax. We were quite happy living farming our little plots of land and sitting by the lake, eating fruit from the trees. We never had to get up and do a job to make somebody else money so they could make their skyscraper bigger.
Well, that's what he said. He said, when he grew up, his parents used to farm their bit of land and they ate what they farmed and any extra they'd barter.
Yeah.
The thing is, he himself was interested in industrialising and modernising and getting cars and Rolexes, and he liked all that stuff. Well, you can't necessarily control the speed of it, but Tibet would have probably ended up ransacked if they'd have done it themselves slowly. Yeah. It just happened incredibly fast because the Chinese did it. But that's inevitably what happens to this planet with humans on. That's what we do.
We rape the land.
We do. And they said as well, the Chinese are taking a lot of money for all of our world's rubbish to be dumped in Tibet. That's all of us. That's on all of us as well.
Yeah.
He tries to see the good in all people. I just see bad in all people.
This is a revelation to me. It's usually me.
I'm a bit down on humanity. Humanity as a whole is just a disaster.
Humanity is a whole.
Ooh.
I totally agree with you, but I don't know how we get back out of that hole now. I don't. We've come too far down.
Throw this planet away and look for another one.
All right, end of podcast.
Yeah.
That's what you get from reading the Dalai Lama's book. Time to throw the planet away. End humanity now.
Yeah. Well, what this Dalai Lama does is he kind of has quite a pleasant life. If it wasn't for the worries of his peoples being completely shat upon after he abandoned them, he'd just be having a great time. It sounds like he lives fairly modestly, but he travels the world being revered, being loved, looked after. He has a laugh. I've watched loads of interviews now and he really does laugh a lot. But how he manages to laugh when everything is so crap, I don't know.
Well, because he's removed from it.
He is he's physically removed from it. I'm sure he spends a lot of time meditating about it.
It's just a difficult juxtaposition, because when you are a leader, whether you're a good leader or a bad leader, you never have to endure what your actual people endure.
I know.
And if your country's at war, you're always going to be safe because you're the leader. you know, you have got exile in India. You're actually not even in your country because you've deemed it's better for me to look after my people while I'm not in the country.
Yeah.
They're being completely massacred. I think 87,000 of them were killed during the first wave of violence.
That's in the first few years.
Yeah.
And then by the time he writes this book, he says it's over a million and a quarter Tibetans have died of assassination, starvation, torture.
That's not just... through warfare, a lot of them killed themselves.
And suicide.
Because life was so bleak there.
And starvation. It's terrible. Yeah, well, meanwhile, they built him some nice houses and a community to live in north of India. So the Tibetans are used to high altitude and cold. Tons of them came over to India. They ended up being given land, but it's south, and a lot of them died of heat stroke. About a third died of heat stroke, and then tuberculosis ripped through them because their living conditions were bad. And then he says, oh, I suggested to Nehru that maybe we could resettle some people but give them work. He said, that's a good idea, and he shipped a few thousand to work on the new roads that were being built. So that sounds like he's done a positive thing.
Yeah.
And then when he visits them a few years later, he realises they're basically in slavery.
It's hard
labour conditions.
Again, isn't it?
Yeah. How could you not see that? Yeah. As soon as he said that, I thought, well, that's hard labour. That's going to be like a prison camp.
Yeah, you know why it's obvious. Doesn't see that? Because he's removed. He's
that's
living in
I
his
think.
Palace.
That's what I do get an element of that. Because how can you be surprised when you finally visit them? But anyway, we can't put all this on him. It's not his fault any of this happened, and it's not for him to fix. But yeah, when he's doing a deal to get his people some work on roads, it's kind of obvious that that's going to be a nightmare.
But I mean, he wants the roads, right? You need the roads because they're settled in places where there are no roads,
right?
Yeah,
I know, but you don't want your people to be prisoners of war.
But you have to build the infrastructure if you're going to settle there.
Yeah, but not at the cost of
But how else are you going to do it? How else are you going to do it?
Well, he did say that after many years, after he'd seen their conditions, they started building villages near the road encampments, so they had a better way of life. There's less death. Anyway, I don't want to criticise. It's a nightmare. It's the whole thing's horrific. Refugees' situations usually are, let's face it.
Yeah, and of course, you know what? He is young. He wasn't expecting this to happen. Everything's being made up as it goes along.
And it's the Chinese who are persecuting the Tibetans to make him leave, not him. Yeah. It's not his fault. And he actually does think that the best thing he can do is go out into the world and be an ambassador to try to put Tibet on the map. And he successfully did that.
No, I get that. Yeah, I think
he really did successfully do that.
And he wrote this book, which has educated us. And obviously, we're probably the last people to read it.
Yeah, yeah. So, we're the last to know. Do you remember when we read the Beastie Boys?
Yes.
And which one was it? Ad Rock was absolutely obsessed with putting on big concerts to help Tibet.
Free Tibet, yeah.
And because he says he goes to America in 1979, 1984... I don't know, it's right around the time when the Beastie Boys were playing, so somehow that got to them.
Oh,
and
then
they started to really raise awareness of Tibet. So what he did do was a lot, and good on him. He's never given up, has he?
He's never given up, but sometimes I do think his ideas and values that he wants us all to live by, this universal responsibility, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it would be a dream. If we could achieve that, you know, the whole thing that we're all on this planet together, we are all essentially the same. Why the hell are we fighting with each other? We all would have enough if we all just helped each other. All the sentient beings on this planet, people and animals, I'm here for it.
But not everyone else is, are they?
But it's
Chairman Mao isn't, is he?
Chairman Mao is but one person who had to come to power and instilled that in the masses. So I think the people who want universal responsibility, and I think most people actually do want to live a quiet life happily, don't really want other people to suffer. It's just we've gone so far down the road of non-universal responsibility, and I think it's just governed by the internet has taken us further away from it. The mass media has taken us further away from it. I just don't know when you have people like Trump in power that people blindly follow. I just don't know how we pull it all back now. I don't know how we stop having wars.
I don't think you do. I never believed you do.
Actually, we've never.
We'll never change.
We never have.
Well, there's no end to it.
There is no end
to it.
There's
lots of loveliness. There's lots of hideousness.
I tell you something. I think there is end to it, but I think we all arrive at it too late. I think it's a thought process that you probably get at the age of like 50, 60. But then I think this feeds into the Dalai Lama and the Buddhism principle of karma. Because the fact is you go through your life cycle, and if you can fulfill your life cycle of not harming anyone, then you get released. But if you constantly do wrong, you'll keep being stuck on this plane.
Yes.
And go through a horrible life again until you learn not to. And I think we all arrive at that too late. And if the world, see, I'm saying it happens at the age of 50 and 60, but the majority of the world leaders are over 50 and 60. Yeah. They're not doing anything about it.
No, I have no hope for humanity.
We're just doomed. We're doomed. Thanks, Dalai Lama. You just absolutely made us realise that we're all doomed.
Correct.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Thrift Shop Biography. We love making this podcast and we're absolutely thrilled that so many of you are already listening. We're new to this and you could really help us out by leaving us a review somewhere, wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you could share us, tell your friends about us or drop some links on social media. We have a Facebook page called Thrift Shop Biography. So make sure you come over there to hear about the episodes first and what else we're up to. Okay, see you next week. And if you're new here, there are loads more episodes now to go and listen in the back catalogue, so make sure you go and enjoy them. Okay, thank you very much. Bye.